Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE's this evening for this event, which forms part of the LSE's 9th Space for Thought Literary Festival. The festival is formally taking place from Monday this week, the 20th, until Saturday, the 25th, with the theme Revolutions. So if you'd like to pick up a program on your way out, do so. My name is Professor Paul Kelly, and I'm a pro-director within the school and a political philosopher, and as I say, it's a great pleasure having the opportunity to welcome you here tonight. This evening's event is hosted by BBC Radio 3's Free Thinking and the LSE Literary Festival. For those Twitter users in the audience, let me get the hashtag right. The hashtag for today's event is #LSELitFest. And I think that's somewhere up there. There it is, behind us. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. There will be a book signing taking place following the event, and you'll find copies of the speakers' books on sale outside the theatre. But now, I have the great pleasure of introducing Anne McElvoy, one of the regular presenters of Free Thinking, who is chairing this evening. Anne.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Good evening. It's 500 years since Martin Luther and his ideas sparked a protest that burned a huge hole through Western Christendom in the 16th century. When he died in 1546 at the age of 63, the Reformation he'd helped to launch had taken hold, and there was no denying that Europe's house stood divided. Yet the glare of events and the tangled politics of his time have obscured the character of Luther and the subtlety of his arguments. What made him a brilliant preacher as well as a foul-mouthed polemicist? A disobedient son and a loyal husband? And of course, what drove him, a lowly friar, to challenge the authority of the Pope? Was he a fundamentalist reactionary or the enlightened creator of our modern world? To help answer these questions, I'm joined by Dermot McCulloch, whose book Reformation won the Wolfson Prize for History, by Ulinka Rublak, author of Reformation Europe, and by Peter Stanford, whose biography, Martin Luther, Catholic Dissident, will be published next month. So, Peter, as the most recent of Luther's many biographers, you're very well placed to tell us a bit about who he was and what kind of man we're dealing with and how his character was formed.
Gosh, that's a lot of questions. What was he like? Well, he liked to tell people that he was the son of a simple farmer, and he told a story about his mother once, where he describes his mother Margaret as the sort of woman who went out and collected wood and carried it in on her back to burn the fire. So he was very keen to present himself as a sort of man of the people, I suppose we would call it now, a man of the sort of lowly classes in Germany. He came from Thuringia in the centre of Germany. His father did come from farming stock, but had done rather well for himself and had owned various mines, or the rights to various mines. His mother, we think, came from the merchant class and was actually taught him how to read early. But the most important thing about his parents really was they were ambitious for him and sent him off to school, not only initially but from the age of 12 onwards, when most people wouldn't have gone on with their education. And their ambitions really stretched to him being a lawyer, particularly his father's ambitions. And one of the tensions in his life early is around his father. And Eric Erickson in the 1950s wrote a famous biography of Luther, very much from the point of view of psychoanalysis, saying that the whole Reformation could be explained by Luther not getting on with his dad and wanting to do down his dad and seeing either the Catholic Church or the Pope as a dad figure, and therefore doing it down. I suppose the Pope does in some way try to be a father in that sense. But so that view of him and Luther. went off to do law, did pretty well at law in Erfurt University. And then the first of a series of thunderbolts. He was a man who seemed to have an awful lot of kind of thunderbolts in his life, in the telling of it. Obviously, there is an element of shaping the narrative in that. Came along in 1505 when he was walking back from his parents to Erfurt to carry on his law studies. There was a terrible thunderstorm, in his account of it, and he promised St. Anne, who was the patron saint of miners, that if she saved his life at that moment, he would go into a monastery. And the thunderstorm happened, he wasn't killed, obviously, and being a man of his word, which I suppose is one of his characteristics, he then went into an Augustinian monastery.
Good, thank you very much. That was in just a few minutes the early life of Martin Luther. And Dermot, it's interesting that sketch that we had from Peter. The image that so many of us have of him now is this sort of rather jowly, religious zealot, or man at least bent on challenging authority no matter what. Do you read his character like that, or is that a bit of a retrofit?
I think retrofit is the right word. He started a reformation, therefore we think, yes, a natural rebel. No, I think he was a natural conformist, really, who found that conformity did not satisfy. He's the sort of man coming from the sort of background which were the absolute backbone of the church. The sort of people, middle rank of society, industrious, valuing scholarship and learning, want their children to get on. These are the sort of people who send their children into the church, their sons into the church. And the church all over Europe had people like Luther running it below the level of the nobility who took the real plum jobs at the top of the church. Below that, it's Luther's. All over the place. But the interesting thing is that this man who is a good friar, the sort of best example of the regular life in early 16th century Europe, simply was not satisfied. There is something in him, a restlessness, a guilt, and the guilt is to do with his relationship with God. And the problem was that the more good deeds he did, the more being a good friar didn't actually satisfy him. That's the problem. Erikson, about whom we've heard, interpreted in terms of psychoanalysis. That seems to me nonsense. You need to interpret it in terms of theology, talking about God and thinking about God. And that's the word. What the word theology means? God talk. And he talked with God, and the answers he got back as a good friar were anger. And accusation, that was the problem.
Gulinka, how easy has it been for you as someone brought up as a Lutheran to gain an impression of the man before we come to the historical figure and where he fits?
Well, it's been very alienating. When you go to school in Germany, you grow up in religious studies, learning a lot of the myths Luther himself furnished about his life. And of course, you grow up with wanting to hero worship. And the more you look at Luther, I do think the more alien he really seems. He's a man who believes more fervently as he develops from his days in the monastery in Erfurt that the world will come to an end. He believes then from 1520 onwards that the papacy as such, as an institution, is the Antichrist, and that means it's an ally of the devil. He's a deeply emotional man, so just as Dermot was saying, he's full of anxiousness and hatred against God when he first enters the monastery. Why does he hate God so much? Because he feels God is so demanding. God is so demanding. I'm praying as much as I can. I'm saying the hour. I'm doing all this. And yet I feel I can never satisfy that God. So I think even as a child, I mean, he must have been really peculiar. And that is why I would slightly disagree with that notion that there were many Luthers. I mean, I think he must have been a very special child. And he certainly was a very special man. When you read sources from the 16th century, it's very rare that people write about themselves. When you read Luther, in 1520, writing to Pope Leo X, it's I, you know, all the way through this this document. Very, very unusual.
It's all about me. But that relentlessness, that drive, Peter, you mentioned the law. Now, he could have stuck at the law. He could have become a formative person in European history in a different way. Why do you think he didn't get along with the law?
He was very damning about the law afterwards. He saw the kind of the dealings of statecraft in, as something that had nothing to do with him. One of the idea that he developed in the 1520s was the idea of two kingdoms. There was a kingdom which was about spiritual matters, and there was a kingdom which was to do with worldly matters. And he wanted to do he wanted nothing to do with that side of it. I mean, that's sort of leaping ahead slightly, and I suppose in some ways that is a reaction to the situation in which he was living, in that the division that we would understand now between religion and politics, between church and state, where we see these things in very separate boxes, increasingly so in our society, just wasn't understood at all. The boundaries between the two were not understood by those in political power, by those in church power, and by those people particularly that Luther appealed to, that sort of lower order sounds rather un Jeremy Corbyn, but that would be a quick way of describing them. They didn't see that difference. They didn't know whether it was the prince or the abbot who was putting them down in that sense. So the law had no appeal for him. But I think one of the things about him going into the monastery, and I think in some ways the story of the Reformation or his part in it, is someone going on what was effectively a private journey at first. This sort of this angry God, this alienation from God. I mean, this was a man who, and you know, as a nice Catholic boy, I rarely go to confession for a very long time. This is a man who used to go to confession virtually every day, several times. And worse, he'd be in there for 3 hours, and then at the end of it, he'd turn around and knock on the door again and say, "I've thought of one more sin that I've just kind of got to get through." He was striving for something and finding only a vacuum. And in many senses, what he then did, and again, this is perhaps a caricature of what lawyers do, is he then turned to the Bible in his inability to sort of contact God, to communicate with God by all the standard means, and started reading what the Bible said. And that's really where his theological breakthrough comes.
Dermot, take us back, if you can, a bit to the confessional box of the time. How unusual or otherwise was that intensity of feeling about belief in it? Different ways. We've heard it from both of you.
Oh, it was a very intense age, and late medieval Western religion was very soaked up by anxiety about death. And the church had created marvelous structures to get you through to the right bit of death, in other words, heaven and not hell. And of course, in the middle was this state, purgatory. Marvelous invention of the church. I mean, it is an invention, but it's an understandable one. Because the trouble about Christianity is that it had this very stark contrast between heaven and hell. And most of us, frankly, don't really deserve either. We're sort of mixtures in the middle. We're mixtures in the middle. And therefore, purgatory, a place where you could work through your imperfections to get towards heaven, was an enormously psychologically satisfying idea, and the point was that you could only go to heaven after purgatory. So purgatory became an industry in the late medieval church. The problem with it is that it has no base in the Bible whatsoever, and it therefore is a problem when you make the Bible the center of Christianity, which, as a text, I mean, which it had not been in the medieval church. The Bible in the medieval church is a source of liturgy. You hear it in little fragments. And what happened in the early 16th century is that people started reading great chunks of it and seeing the logic of it. Instead of it being the basis of worship, it became the basis of ideas. And there, purgatory is not. And that was the center of Luther's rebellion against the church.
Does that sound right to you, Olinka? That
yes.
Mixture of psychology, but also a beginnings of emergence of a philosophy.
Yes, absolutely. It's interesting to note that there are 18 full Bibles that are already circulating in Germany, before at Luther's time, before he starts translating it in German. And next to France, Germany was the country where really most of these Bibles being available. So it's an age where many people are searching for these questions about salvation, intensely religious.
So, Peter, this private turmoil finds a public expression, and I'm interested in why, and I think you've chosen a passage to read that illustrates that.
Yes, this is a passage from what are called the Table Talks. So from 1530, well, Luther marries in 1525 and goes to live with his wife Katharina in the Black Cloister, which had been the Augustinian monastery where he'd been a friar, in Wittenberg. And they take in lodgers, basically. They haven't got a lot of money, and lots of people want to hear the great man. And they sit round his table, and he sort of he reworks his life. And obviously there are dangers with someone reworking their life. We all rework our life into anecdotes, and one of the problems for any biographer is that. But you also get a kind of pretty authentic sound of Luther's voice here. So this is from a table talk he gave in 1531, so one of the early ones. His guests would sit there and write it all down and then publish it afterwards. It became a great publishing industry, Luther's things. And just to explain a couple of the terms before I get there, one is indulgences, which probably lots of you will know, but basically it was this idea. We were talking about salvation, we were talking about death, that the church would sell basically pieces of paper that said you got a free pass into purgatory and up into heaven, or if your relatives were struggling in purgatory, if you paid enough, you could upgrade them to heaven, really. It's the very basic idea. And this was going on in a town outside Saxony, but very close, called Jutterburg. And sorry, my pronunciation's probably bad, but and Luther was very, very cross about it. This wasn't his idea of salvation at all. So this is how he describes what happened to him. Oh, and the person who was selling them was a man called Johann Tetzel, who was a Dominican, and he was raising money for the rebuilding of St. Peter's in Rome. So it's a very long explanation, but I promise you it's a relatively short reading. Tetzel started preaching the sale of his indulgence in Jutterburg, and all the people ran to him as though they were possessed. Little by little, I began to persuade people otherwise and to explain to them what grace and forgiveness of sins meant. By then, when Tetzel still went shamelessly forward, I published the theses concerning indulgences. That started a storm in the entire world. At that time, I still regarded the Pope as my lord. I thought I'd done him a favour, but he attacked me with all his strength. That's why I had to defend myself and take up arms until indulgences, monasteries, and endowments for celebrating masses have all fallen, and then the Pope right after them. Thus has God attacked the Pope with the weakest of weaknesses, and through weakness will bring him down, no matter how much the devil growls and howls.
Growls and howls, indeed. And Luther wasn't the first person to complain about this trade in indulgences. So what was it that made the opposition so significant, Ulinka?
Yes, I mean, it's a very interesting fact to know that in a large German city like Speyer in 1502, a campaign to run the indulgences has brought in 3,000 florins, and now in 1517 only 200. So in other cities the same happens. That's why they're going to these small places like Jutterburg, because they know it's already a losing game. Yeah, it's quite expensive, so Tetzel and his team, to keep them afloat, you need 300 florins a month, so they actually beginning to lose money. The indulgences have been criticized for decades by then, when Luther starts to write his 95 thesis and says in one of the theses, he says that really you should spend on the works of charity and not on anything like this.
Who would like to clear up the story of nailing theses to the church door?
It's a problem. Did he nail those 95 theses to the door? And I've veered in my career as to whether I believe it or not. I think I've now come down to thinking it probably happened. And the reason for that... reason for that is that the month before, Luther did do that about another disputation. It's all about... It's a university seminar. It's being advertised on the door, which is the university notice board. So if he did that in September 1517, why should he not have done it in October 1517 on this other issue? And we have the printed sheet advertising that first seminar about something completely different in September. So that's the reason I now believe it.
In the spirit of the Reformation, any dissent, Peter?
I think if you read the 95 Theses, which are sort of propositions for debate, each of them is about three or four sentences long. And they would have to be a very, very, very large set of doors. It'd be a bit like hanging wallpaper. Or it would have to use very, very small writing. A lot of the evidence would rather suggest that things would be not nailed up but put up with wax. And as we've said before, Luther both spoke and wrote extensively about himself and his own life, much more, really, than any other figure in that century. And nowhere does he mention nailing anything to doors. What he talks about is sending the 95 Theses to his local archbishop, Albrecht, who was part of the indulgence racket. And Albrecht, being rather cowardly and sort of wavered between reform and not reform, then sent them off to Rome. So that's really what got it started. We can debate whether the nailing happened or not. I think probably unlikely.
Ulrike, briefly on that, but how did the Pope respond?
So I agree with the pinning rather than hammering. The question is, why does this matter so much to us? And it is, of course, because of the 19th century image of Luther as the heroic man with a hammer, and I think we don't need that image really. You know, as you said, what matters really is that he has the courage to write to his archbishop, to Albrecht. And then also what matters is that he starts a media campaign, so he makes sure that they get printed in Leipzig, because Wittenberg at that time is a town which he himself feels is beyond civilization. I mean, it hasn't got a printing press. So he's clever in using media to his advantage from the start. So what happens then is obviously that he gets interviewed and then in 1519, and then he is declared heretic, and he burns the bull that will declare him heretic. So very quickly, one of the other things we really must say about Luther is, because you refer to Erikson in that book, Young Man Luther, the iconic image of him is also as a young man. And I always wanted to write a book with the title Luther Was Never Young. I mean, I mean, you can think of him, I mean, he's born in 1483. He's really a man of the late Middle Ages in that sense. And he's what you might call a slow developer. He's not someone who publishes very young or does any of that. These deeds would stand out. So by the time he really gets his public profile, he's a mature man.
Dermot, I think you wanted a quick word on that, and then you might read for us perhaps from the first-hand account that you found of how Luther and his followers were changing things in Germany.
Yeah, this is very interesting. It's the account of a Greek coming to Germany after Lutheranism had been established in certain cities. So it's an outsider, a Greek Orthodox, looking at this world of the Reformation, which was happening all around. So this man who is a diplomatic envoy, actually employed by the Emperor Charles V, visited Augsburg, which by then was a firmly Lutheran city. So here's this slightly puzzled Greek looking at Augsburg and looking at Lutheranism. Their observances have nothing in common with or even similar to the church that I know. As far as the creed is concerned, they make no innovations, but they are absolutely at odds over the traditions of the church and set them quite to one side. They admit neither commemorations nor services for the saints, neither fasting nor Lent. They do work on all the days of the week, but they have a very special respect for Sunday. As for images and statues of the saints, they do not wish to have them either in their churches or their homes. They've thrown out the whole apparatus of monks and monasteries and have reduced their clerics to the status of ordinary people. They've drawn up no clerical rankings, saying that things like this are inventions of the superstitious. On Sunday, they come together in their churches, and there, men and women of all ages mingling together sit in rows. Someone reckoned to know Scripture well goes up into the pulpit and explains the message of the gospel at great length, while everyone listens attentively. When the sermon is over, they sing tuneful rhythmic hymns in praise, as they say, of Christ. After the hymn singing is done, they return home, and before starting their own meal, send a share to their needy neighbours. They act no differently in their churches. As for baptism, They choose certain men who are acknowledged by everyone to have upright lives and other fine qualities. And these men baptize the children according to their custom, though they don't sing so many hymns. Simplicity in worship is their normal practice. They abominate the archbishop of the city of Rome and hurl 10,000 insults at him, written and otherwise. And in no way at all do they deign to submit to the dogmas of the Roman Church. And in no way at all do they deign to submit to the dogmas of the Roman Church. These people call themselves evangelicals, claiming for themselves what they believe is a correct understanding of the gospel, evangelium. They reckon that all other Christians are the victims of superstition and delusion, and they are fiercely possessive of their own style of worship. No one could alter their views by persuasive argument, and they hold them with very great determination, even to death.
Thank you very much. That sounded like David Attenborough describing new species that he just discovered. It does really paint a very vibrant picture of how odd it must have appeared to some people.
Yeah, but by complete accident, Luther had invented a church. He'd not set out to do that at all. He was trying to correct and return the church to its old traditions. And the name Augustine of Hippo sounds through his work, this 4th and 5th century theologian of the church. He's trying to get the church back on course to this great Latin theologian. The trouble was, the church had got so far off course that doing this was a revolution.
And what's the spirit of it? I mean, there is a view that it is discursive from the start, that you're invited to discuss what is being put up, or is it in the end Luther who decides, and always Luther who knows that he is going to decide?
Well, he didn't like being contradicted, and he wasn't, let's face it, a logical thinker. He had certain great impulses, and he could argue the logic of those impulses, but the impulses might clash, and that was the problem.
Well, Olenka, do you agree with that?
I would certainly agree with saying that one of his most difficult aspects as a person is that he always needs to be right. He absolutely always needs to be right. And that is, of course, fatal when you are looking to create compromise in a new church. And, I mean, cities like Augsburg are actually very pluriform in their confessional interests, so that we have Zwinglians, people who are shaped by the ideas of the Zurich reformer Zwingli there. Geoffrey Dickens, a Reformation historian, once coined that phrase, the Reformation was an urban event. It was just, you know, something that happened very quickly. Augsburg, in fact, is a very good example for how protracted these discussions are, how difficult they are, and how much you need someone who can build bridges. And now Luther was exactly the person to burn bridges. Well, why is that? And here, I mean, we've already talked about his sense, which is fundamental, really to understand him, that he sees himself at the end of time. And linked to this is his great belief in the devil. So as the great biographer Heiko Obermann put it, for Luther, you're born with, baptized with Christ, and that means you're against Satan. He sees himself between God and the devil, and that is why everything is at stake in every exchange, every negotiation, and that is why he so much wants to be right.
Dermot, are there other sticking points blocking reconciliation here? Are there structural difficulties as well as psychological traits of Martin Luther?
Well, the problem is that he challenged the authority of the church. He denied that the church could control the afterlife. And by doing that, he challenged the church's power. He challenged the power of the entire clerical estate. That's a real problem. But the only problem after that was that the reformers, the Protestant reformers, could not agree amongst themselves. And on the biggest issue of the Christian faith, that the meal of the Eucharist, the Holy Communion, the breaking of bread and wine, what's it mean? Well, the old church said that when you do Eucharist, when you do Eucharist, you are creating the body and blood of Christ out of bread and wine. And Martin Luther agreed with that. Martin Luther did not disagree with the Pope on that. Other Protestant reformers did. And so you got the awful position, as early as the 1520s, that the Reformation movement was split down the middle about that fundamental thing, and all sorts of other disagreements followed. So you've got Luther on one side, you've got the reformers of Zurich on the other, Ulrich Zwingli, and they never agreed. Protestantism has never reunited.
Peter, let's perhaps look at Luther as an antagonist to Rome. And the description of the Pope is an antichrist. Strong words, as we say in the House of Commons. Strong words, Minister. But what did he mean by that?
Well, the Antichrist is there in the Book of Revelation. So the Antichrist is sort of linked with the devil, but isn't the devil. It's the person who will sort of bring down Christianity, or attempts to bring down Christianity, in the Book of Revelation, the sort of apocalyptic last book of the New Testament. But I think it's important. Well, a couple of things, just picking up on what people have said before. The idea that Luther felt himself sort of torn between God and the devil doesn't make him particularly unusual in the medieval age. That was really, a lot of people felt that. I mean, I think, you know, now when we think about Luther, and, you know, what a lot of people will remember about Luther is that he felt his bowels were possessed by the devil, which is why he was so constipated all the time. And we just think he must be bonkers. And probably he was, to a certain extent. He's certainly constipated. But you know, that wasn't so unusual that people would, you know, epilepsy was seen as the work of the devil. That's the age in which he's a man of his time in that sense. Another thing, this kind of anger that comes out in his language, there was a good reason for it in one sense, in that he spoke as the people around him spoke. Most of his texts came out in German rather than Latin, so people could understand what he was saying. And the language that he used was not quite the language of the street, but it was that sort of language rather than highfalutin language, which used concepts that people didn't particularly understand. And we've talked very briefly about the way that he kind of hit back at things. He was a very angry man in many ways. And so one of the things that he says in his writings is that he has to be angry to write. And I think what most of us think, particularly in the email age, is that if we write an email in anger, we leave it till the next morning before we press send. Luther never did that. Now, I might be reminding you of someone at the moment who tweets as he watches CNN. And there are parallels here, the populist, the kind of overthrowing the establishment, all of those things. They're there with Luther and Trump. But I think you have to ask about that anger as well. And it seems to me that with Luther, there are peaks and troughs. He's a man whose mood changes a great deal, and I think that's behind a lot of that vehemence that comes out.
I'm very impressed that you leave it till the next day before you press send when you've written a cross email. How delightful you must be to deal with. But Ulrika, that sense of the language, and as a Germanist I always found this so fascinating by the fact that there's imagery of everything from defecation and the way he describes things in these very round tones. I mean, can you give us an example of his language, and what's particular about it? What makes you think, yes, that's a Luther phrase?
Well, he says, for example, he's going to give the devil a fart as a staff. And it's just one of the many, many abuses he enjoys. So it's for him, it's a very creative language, but it's this dark, sarcastic humor which he wants to use as a weapon against the devil. It's very real for him. So I would disagree. I mean, I agree with you that anger is a great motivating force for him, but I disagree on this the sense that, oh, well, Middle Ages, you know, lots of people felt like that about the devil. If you look at Erasmus, the great humanist, I mean, you almost don't find
but
that...
But
then who is typical, who's not? If you look at Zwingli, it's not there. If you look at Spalt, you know, the people around Melanchthon, the people around Luther, there is something particular, and that is, of course, relating to the earlier statement, we don't need psychoanalysis. That is, of course, the reason why you have to at least take time to think breakthrough are psychoanalytic interpretations, because in my view there is really something very peculiar about his personality. He stands out as this man, as we already said, you know, he's larger than life, he needs to be top dog all the time, he needs to be right, and he has this very peculiar, vivid imagination of the devil. He somatizes it, he then associates the devil also with the papacy, but you know, there's a big meeting in 1530 in Augsburg where precisely this question of how you mediate is at stake, and he says to his closest team worker, Melanchthon, well, you know, should I come down and I'll see, look into the teeth of Satan? And he means this literally.
He really does.
Yeah, he really does. Yeah. And he sees himself fighting that fight. The devil is assaulting him the whole time, he feels.
How do we know about it? We know because he rushes into print. And I wonder, Dermot, how good do you think he was at getting his message across?
Oh, enormously good. I mean, he is one of the creators of modern German, apart from anything else. But the one thing we've not mentioned about him was that he's extremely funny. So much of his impact was to make people laugh at the old church. And we've already heard Olinka talking about farting at the devil. Well, that's funny, isn't it? It was meant to be funny. It was meant to take the devil's power away by laughter. But this quality of being able to use language, his hymns, that's the other thing we must put on the table, that the hymns are hugely important. And the strength of the words. I mean, German is notoriously a language with lots of syllables in words, but not Luther's hymns. So simple, ein fester Burg ist unser Gott. That wonderful quality of things which ordinary people can sing and get into their bloodstream. That's the great thing. And he is a scholar. He does write beautiful Latin too, funny Latin. So he can do both. He can do this international language, which means that his work can be read anywhere in Europe because it's in Latin.
But how much do you think then, I'm going to bring Peter in on this point, how much do you think this relationship that we associate now with Luther and the mass printing press is driven by the fact that he sees potential and goes for it? He's an early tech entrepreneur, if you will. Or is it just, it's there, it's happening, and he rides the wave of it?
No, I think he embraces it. There are many. Sometimes he tries to pretend that he doesn't. He puzzles as to how the printers have got hold of his texts. But not only does he do his texts are actually texts, though I'm using a kind of modern phrase. That, I mean, the texts of his sermons or his tracts. They're printed up and they circulate very rapidly. So he realizes quite quickly, and yeah, it's key. We're talking about an obscure friar from a sort of backwoods part of Germany that somehow suddenly, in an age of relatively poor communications, this message spreads around Germany, spreads around Switzerland, spreads around Europe, gets to Rome very, very quickly. And it's all through the kind of the printed word. But it's not just the printed word, because I think you have to realise that at this time, what was very important to Luther wasn't just appealing to kind of archbishops and theologians and princes and people who could read. We're also in an age of widespread illiteracy, which again may have something to do with the interest in the devil. And these pamphlets and texts that were sent around, a lot of them would be illustrated. And it was the illustration. So even if you couldn't read them, you could get the gist of what he was saying, again, by these rather satirical cartoons. It's a bit like a kind of version of Private Eye going round and giving you a sense of what's going on in the church. And, you know, and we know when he was facing the Diet of Worms in 1521, they were meant to be judging him. Out in the street were all these pamphlets and posters and leaflets presenting Luther as a kind of new St. Paul, out to kind of take things back to the clarity of the purity of the early church. So very, very important, a kind of social media entrepreneur before his time.
And as well as exploiting the printed word for quickfire responses, Luther used the printing press to set out more considered thoughts too. And Linke, you've chosen an extract from his essay, The Bondage of the Will, that goes to the heart of his disagreement with Rome and to the heart of his teaching.
Yes, so I've chosen this precisely for that reason. It goes to the heart of his theology, and I find it a very moving exchange with that great cult intellectual of the time, Erasmus of Rotterdam, who's been writing about the freedom of will in 1524. Luther responds with his treatise on the bondage of will in 25. You have to remember we're now, in a very different situation. It's the height of the Peasants' War. Everything has erupted socially. The forces all over Germany. And he grapples theologically with that question, can there be anything you as believer can contribute to your salvation still? And he outlines that as he has experienced himself, you just cannot. And you have to experience the generosity of God's gift, that grace is actually already given to you. But note just at the end that he then interestingly hesitates around the question about whether all are actually saved. And the second point I'd like you to note is that he's also in this quotation so dependent on God being strong for him and God on whom belief focuses being almost overpowerful figure. So this is from The Bondage of Will, 1525. If I lived and worked to all eternity, my conscience would never reach comfortable certainty as to how much it must do to satisfy God. Whatever work I'd done, there would still be a nagging doubt as to whether it pleased God or whether he required something more. The experience of all who seek righteousness by works proves that, and I learned it well enough myself over a period of many years to my own great hurt. But now that God has taken my salvation out of the control of my own will and put it under the control of his and promised to save me, not according to my working and running, but according to his own grace and mercy, I have the comfortable certainty that he is faithful and will not lie to me, and that he is also great and powerful, so that no devils or opposition can break him or pluck me away from him. Thus it is that, if not all, yet some, indeed many, are saved, whereas by the power of free will none at all could be saved, but every one of us would perish.
And salvation there doesn't seem to have much with good works, but everything to do with faith.
That's right.
Why is that all right?
Well, that's the heart of his message. That's what he finds when he reads Paul's letter to the Romans and is still struggling with that sense that it's so hard of God to demand these good works. And then he reads it and finds that actually everything is free, everything is given. You just have to believe in Christ, who has taken on the sins of the world. And he, of course, believes fundamentally in that sinfulness of human beings. You can right yourself in absolutely no way. So he finds great liberation in this. It's very interesting when he circulates a 95 thesis, he changes his name. He's actually not born Martin Luther, but Martin Luder, which is a slightly unfortunate name to have because it means something like, and you can help me, it means, well, dissolute. And he changes it to Luther because that's an allusion to the Greek Eleuterio, which means the freed one. And that is his own experience. He's been freed, note the hesitation though, but he's been freed by being able to believe that the grace of God is already granted.
And Dermot, it might seem with the benefit of hindsight that Luther has many of the best tunes as far as reformers are concerned. So, thought experiment, why would any right-thinking person want to disagree with him?
Because there is a problem within this theology of being good. It's marvellously liberating to think that you don't need to pile up good works. But the trouble is, after that, you might think, well, is there any point in being virtuous? Or rather, is there any point in not being evil? Because God is going to do everything. You might as well have a good time and indulge in every possible vice. It's the Protestant problem. And it's the problem for a view of theology which sees that says God is everything, God is all-powerful, human beings are nothing. Well, why don't why the hell don't we just behave exactly as we feel like? It's a problem which is not just Protestantism. It goes right back to those theologies of Paul the Apostle and Augustine, because it's a basic Christian problem.
It's quite enticing offer as well, isn't it, Peter?
But he tries to deal with that, doesn't he? Because having outlined the position as we've just heard, he then writes about what the point of good works is. He's not telling people not to do good works. In many ways, he's telling people to do good works sort of in imitation of Christ. He's just saying that the highest premium shouldn't be put on good works. I think the kind of fundamental problem is more than that, though, because what he effectively does, and what's very, very important with Luther is he translates the Bible into German. So he basically gives people, instead of being told by experts what Jesus is about, what the Gospels might tell you, he gives people the power who don't know Latin but who know German to read it. And once you've done that, and he says everything must come down to Scripture, there must be a scriptural justification for things, you end up with this terrible fragmented, you know, four of us could read bits of Scripture and take a different meaning from it. And that's why his sort of Protestant Reformation, in a way, very quickly fragments, because people simply can't agree without that overall authority.
Luther's early career does seem to show a determination to speak up for the poor, for those left behind by the rich and the powerful. But when the peasants rise up in Germany in 1524, he doesn't take their side. Why?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I would support the notion that he's hugely on the side of the poor at any point in his life, really. I mean, that's why it's so odd. You know, you were saying he claims that he's of peasant stock. I mean, you know, which he's not. His father is as well of Smaltemaster. I mean, and he's very keen to regulate charity, but that means that he wants to make sure that charity only goes to the register, respectable poor. But other than that, you know, he's not a revolutionary ever. And then, of course, fatally, when people rise up, and see real potential in arguing for a new world through the Bible and saying, look, the fish in the rivers are free for us to catch. It's given its nature. It's given by God to everybody, and so on and so forth. He makes absolutely clear that his church is going to be one of strict obedience to the authorities. And that is, of course, what wins him favor with the princes. And we haven't talked about Germany as a political structure at that time. So it's part of the Holy Roman Empire. It's full of little and larger principalities. And many of these rulers have been looking for someone who can contribute to church reform, but also that greater separation of church and state. And Luther, by firmly saying, I'm going to be a man of never advocating that anyone should take up arms, of advocating obedience, is then the kind of leader they're looking for.
Exactly, and he has a sense of duty, doesn't he, Dermot, to the elector of Saxony. How much is he driven by pragmatics as well?
Very much. He owed everything to the Elector of Saxony, who is his prince, because the Elector was in a peculiar position of power within the empire. His vote would count in the next election of a Holy Roman Emperor. It's an elective monarchy. So the Elector of Saxony mattered. And the Elector of Saxony, for reasons we really can't understand, backed him through thick and thin. And so naturally, yes, he likes princes if they're on his side, but he's not actually that enthusiastic about worldly power, because it is by its nature sinful. And its relationship with the Christian church and Christians is always a bit problematic then. Can you have a Christian prince? Well, you can say, all right, this prince is doing the right things for the church, but otherwise princely rule by itself is problematic. Romans chapter 13 in the Paul's epistle to Romans says you've got to obey the princes because they're from God. But that doesn't mean to say they're good princes.
Let's turn to the home life of Luther. He writes about the secular and the religious, and it flows together for him in his discussion of marriage, Ulinka.
Yes, it's very important that he, of course, reduces the number of sacraments from seven to two. So marriage, for instance, is no longer a sacrament. He also says that everybody should be married. One of the most revolutionary issues he fights for is that he says nobody can be celibate. It's not a more sacred life. And of course, he's against any form of taboo. There's no food taboos other than, I think, cannibalism. There's no asceticism that is advocated. And he endorses family life. Now, what's interesting about, you'd like me to read the passage here,
yes,
from
you,
his treatise on
the estate of marriage.
That's right, from 1522, is that it shows nonetheless that he doesn't distinguish between flesh and the spirit. That's fundamental also for his theology against all those who believe that you can overcome the flesh to live the life of the spirit. He doesn't think that. Why does he not think that? Again, because he believes with Augustine in the fundamental sinfulness of everyone. So, yes, have a family life, but it will still be sinful. What's also interesting to me about this passage is that it shows that he's politically actually quite out of tune and unrealistic here. He advocates that you should marry as quickly as possible. Again, not in touch with the reality of most people at the time, who could only marry around the age of 30. So I'll read that now. To sum up the matter, whoever finds himself unsuited to the celibate life should see to it right away that he has something to do and work at. Then let him strike out in God's name and get married. A young man should marry at the age of 20 at the latest, a young woman at 15 to 18, that's when they're still in good health and best suited for marriage. Let God worry about how they and their children are to be fed. God makes children, he surely will also feed them. With all this extolling of married life, however, I have not meant to ascribe to nature a condition of sinlessness. On the contrary, I say that flesh and blood, corrupted through Adam, is conceived and born in sin. Intercourse is never without sin, but God excuses it by his grace because the estate of marriage is his work, and he preserves in and through the sin all that good which he has implanted and blessed in marriage. It's important to note also that written in 1522, Luther is very keen to marry off all his colleagues in Wittenberg, but he himself only marries in 1525, so much later.
We'll come back to that in a second, but I was intrigued that intercourse is still seen as a sin. Peter, I'll just bring you in briefly on this. He doesn't go down what you thought was the easy route, which is to say this is blessed by God, go enjoy.
No, he was very Catholic in that way, really, wasn't he, in that sense? And I suppose one of the interesting things that Luther does, and certainly this becomes more marked as he goes forward, and it comes back again to this idea of the legitimate area of the kind of rulers, the two kingdoms thing, is that he shuffles off a lot of these rather tricky decisions around marriage and divorce and kind of sexual matters, and he sort of says that's nothing to do, really, with the kind of spiritual life and the kingdom of the spirit. That's for secular rulers to deal with. And he gets himself in a few rather knotty situations. There's one of the German princes who supported him through thick and thin was Philip of Hesse, who ends up, from memory, he's married very young to someone he doesn't get on very well with, or it doesn't really work, the marriage. And he takes a mistress and wants to sort of sort that out. Now, having sort of pulled away from the Catholic Church's system of annulments, where you can wipe away marriages as if they never happened, Luther's a bit stuck. So he basically says to Philip of Hesse, well, you know, some of the prophets in the Old Testament, they had more than one wife. So if you don't tell anybody, you can have another wife as well. Unfortunately, his bride's mother, spills the beans. And that puts him in a difficult situation. But he doesn't seem... He's very un-Catholic in the sense that he's not very interested in regulating what goes on in other people's bedrooms as much as the Catholic Church certainly was, and some people might argue still is. So he's an interesting mixture there.
Olinka, your reading proceeds by a few years his own marriage to the runaway nun, Katharina von Bora, and it seems quite theoretical. You read that very much in that spirit. Why, after so many years of being disinclined to take the vows, do you think he opts to marry?
Well, for him, it was a fundamental break. That's why it's interesting. It only happens in 1525. Once more, he thought in 1524 the world would come to an end with a big flood. It hasn't. So he says, okay, I'm now going to marry finally. He hasn't got great hopes for it. But actually, it's for the first time seems to alleviate itself, at least for some time, you know, his what we would nowadays call a depressive moments. And he has six children, and he's embroiled suddenly in this new life. He's taken the decision on principle, as I just say, he thinks this must be done, but then finds himself in a new world of feeling. Well, only up to a certain level, so he insists that his wife, up to the end, calls him Dr. Martin Luther. He's very proud of his doctoral title. So there's an intimacy there. But the whole realm of sexuality is now no longer one of the law. It is sinful, but you can enjoy it. And there are real exchanges amongst the reformers that talk about the pleasure of heterosexual, of course, rigidly heterosexual sex. So sodomy, again, is something associated with the life in Rome. And it's very moving to see how intimately he interacts also with his children. He talks about changing nappies at home. And then he's very moved, for instance, when his second daughter dies age 12. All this is part of the ordinariness of life which Luther embraces. And that's what I find in him very attractive still, that he embraces ordinariness and says there's nothing. He talks a lot about reason as a whole. He says if you go with reason, the first thing you would do is not to change nappies, not to smell foul bottoms. You would be a monk and a nun. You must get yourself involved in precisely this.
Many of us have changed nappies who can see the sense of that. There's a lighter side to his character, and also a slight sending up of his own escapades, Dermot. One is his claim to have been a famous lover because three of the fugitive nuns who ran away with Caterina had been living with him in his home at some time. So there is that sense of humour, and I think it when we focus on him, we ought to bear that in mind.
Yes, and he is a lover of paradox. There are some thinkers who love synthesizing, making logical. Luther gloried in absurd paradox. And so he can say something which sounds completely paradoxical and puzzling. I wonder if I can read something which is Luther in playful mode. We think of Luther as a scripture alone man, that's the only authority, and rejecting law. Well, listen to this. It's from a work he did on secular authority. There's a story told of Duke Charles of Burgundy. A nobleman captured his enemy. The wife of the captive came to ransom her husband. The nobleman said he would give the man back to her if she slept with him. The woman was virtuous, but wanted her husband released, and so she went and asked her husband whether she should do it to get him freed. The man wanted to be free and to save his life, and allowed it. But the day after the nobleman had slept with the woman, he had her husband beheaded and gave him back to her dead. The woman complained to Duke Charles, who summoned the nobleman and ordered him to take the woman as his wife. After the wedding day, he had the man beheaded, placed the woman in possession of his goods, and restored her honour. A truly princely punishment on wickedness. Now, no pope, no lawyer, and no book could have taught him to give such a verdict. Rather, it came from unfettered reason, which is greater than all the laws in books. It is so just a judgment that everybody is bound to approve it and find written in his heart that it is right. Augustine writes the same in his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount. And therefore, written law is to be held in lower regard than reason. For indeed, reason is the source of all laws, that from which they sprang. The source is not to be constricted by the stream, and reason is not to be held captive by letters.
Well, that's certainly got a Homeric force, that tale. What point do you think Luther wants us to take away? We obviously enjoys the telling. What's the takeaway for
him? Well, one point is that the laws of the church and the laws of sinful humanity are as nothing. But the interesting paradox, it seems to me, is that Scripture alone doesn't seem to be there. I mean, I think he might resolve it by saying the Bible is the expression of reason. But still, there's a little anxious seed there which leads us on in Protestantism to viewing the mind, the God-given reason, as the source of authority, the ultimate source of authority.
I think this is a very good moment to hear from our audience. If you have some questions, just put up your hand in the time-honoured way. And we have stewards bringing microphones. Who would like to get us going? You've heard so many great Luther stories. There must be some. I'm looking for a hand, and I'll make... there's a hand about the third row. Yes, just where you are, sir. You don't need to hold it right up to your lips, because that can give us a bit of distortion, but...
I'd like to ask the panel... is it working?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. To what degree do they believe that Luther's book, Von den Juden und ihren Lügen, The Jews and Their Lies, is responsible for European anti-Semitism and possibly for the Holocaust, bearing in mind that a lot of the Nazis continuously cited Luther's anti-Semitic, comments.
Peter, we haven't touched on this yet, so no. Luther's anti-Semitism.
You're absolutely right about the Nazis embracing those parts of Luther's writings. They visited the Black Cloister in, I think it was 1933, 1934, and it was all draped in Nazi flags. And they sort of appealed to Luther, those writings of Luther, to justify what they did in the Holocaust. There are two main documents that Luther writes about the Jews. One is in, I think, 1522, where he is relatively tolerant for the times, really, in his attitudes to Jews. Actually, one of the things he says about marriage, where, even in my parents' generation, Catholics weren't meant to marry out. Luther's saying there, marry a Muslim, marry a Jew, marriage is what you want to make it. So at that stage, he might be seen rather more tolerant. The other really important thing to remember about Luther is he may never have met a Jew. Wittenberg wasn't a place with a kind of Jewish ghetto. Luther travels very, very, very little outside the place where he lives, which again is extraordinary given his impact on Europe. And then towards the end of his life, he writes this absolutely revolting piece about the Jews, where he talks about burning synagogues, and which is the one you're referring to that the Nazis took on board. I really don't want to make excuses for him. I think when people get older, sometimes towards the end of their life, they get things wrong. They may exaggerate their view, but that's an excuse, and that isn't good enough. I mean, I think.
Well, Luca, I'd like to bring you in on that as well, if I could. Is it just a question of he sort of loses it or loses the plot, and it all gets sort of extreme? Your last point, or do you interpret the whole?
No. It's certainly not. I mean, we can look at his early treatises against usury, where he's already putting out these stereotypes of the Jews. Then we have 1523, the treatise that is more conciliatory. Well, why is it so? Because he still believes that the Jews can be converted. And once he loses that hope, he writes in 1543 this extraordinary hate language. And it's, of course, part of a phase in his life, where he's once. He feels that even in Wittenberg things are not as they should be, and he's generally depressed about the state of what he's created. But I think it absolutely follows on logically from his whole theology. He hates the Jews because, once more, what they do is to follow the law.
Dermot.
It has to be said, he wrote an equally nasty pamphlet in that last phase on the Turks. It's all the people who have not converted. He's started this great revolution, which God presumably had put in place, and these people are standing out against it. So they are the enemies of God.
Let's go to another question, if we could. Who else? Everyone's getting warmed up now. Yes, sir. Yes, gentleman here. Thank you.
Really a comment. I was glad the panel alluded to the political structures in Germany, particularly the position of Saxony. In the early decades of the 16th century. It's important, I think, to also to allude to the military balance of power, because within a year of Luther's death, of course, you have the major Battle of Mühlberg in 1547, which really upsets things it upsets the succession of Saxony in many ways. It becomes rather, I think, splintered and fragmented after that. And, of course, it leads to a kind of, I think, a kind of interim settlement, an interim sort of political settlement as well. So it's important really to bear in mind the sort of balancing of the political but also the military, you know, sort of structures of power and the parameters of power, really, which are very clearly defined, I think, from 1547. Thank you.
Who'd like a word on
I think what's important in considering Luther's story is a lot of the things that he said theologically had been said before. Some of the things that he said had been said by people like Jan Hus, who was burnt at the stake, which is clearly what the Catholic Church, the Catholic authorities would have liked to do with Luther. And the reason that that doesn't happen to him is absolutely because of the political situation in Germany, that you have these different princes that we've talked about before, feeling their way through a camp. They want a more relaxed relationship with the papacy. They don't want to be overseen. They feel exploited financially, and so they exploit Luther in a way. It's a two-way process, and that's absolutely key, because I think one of the key questions about Luther is how he manages to die a natural death, and it's particularly with those terrible bowels that he had. But it's because of that political situation.
In the spirit of Katharina von Bohr, I'm wondering if any women in the audience might have a question. And of course it doesn't have to be about Katharina von Bohr. Yes, go for it. Thank you. Rising to the challenge. Thank you. Mike's coming over. Blue mic.
So this evening you've already made the analogy to Trump. I was just wondering, given your comments, is he a genuine man of the people? If you think about somebody like Nigel Farage standing there with a pint in his hand, speaking about that, yeah, he's clearly from some kind of an elitist background, being a trader. So I'd be interested in your opinions on that.
Olinka, man of the people.
I think he's certainly not a man of the people. You have to remember that he lives then, because he's under the imperial ban, he can't travel out of this very small enclave in which he lives. He's mostly in Wittenberg, this really a town without any trade networks or anything linked to it. And he lives in an artificial society. He inhabits this monastery with lots of students and guests and so on. It's a university, tiny university town. So he doesn't meet ordinary people very much. And also, as I said already, he's not a political thinker then anymore. So after the 1520 address to the German nobility that outlined some political points, he never does anything similar again. So he's much more remote. He doesn't indulge in the nationalism of the first years anymore after 1520 very much. So I don't see the analogy with Trump really working.
There's a little twitch of a finger there from Dermot.
He's not a man of the people, but he's a man for the people, and that's not a glib thing to say, because what is he? He is a friar. And what is a friar? Friars are communicators in the medieval church. They're not like monks. That's why Luther isn't a monk. He's a friar. They're the people who preach. They're the preferential preachers. That's what he did for the rest of his life. He preached the word of God. And we made a little fun of him being called by his wife Dr. Martin Luther for the rest of his life. Well, that's what he was. That's what his authority came from. He was a doctor of theology. He was a professor of theology. And that gave him the authority, the only authority he had to preach his message, the word of God.
Any more questions? There's a little flurry over here. Why don't we take a couple together? I mean, one after each other. You know what I mean. So, we'll start down here, and then we'll take another one from up there. Yes, sir.
Thank you. It's been very interesting. But you haven't actually addressed the question. Is he a fundamentalist reactionary or an enlightened creator of the modern world?
Right. We are going to, I should say. We will. That is one of our sort of closing thoughts. So what should we hold our thoughts, or someone give us an answer. I think this gentleman deserves an answer. give an answer to this enticing question, but we will come back to it. Yes, Peter.
I think we've given different shades of opinion on that, haven't we? There are elements of him that perhaps were fundamentalist, a fundamentalist belief in the Bible. But I think Some of the ways in which he was enlightened were almost by accident. In talking about, you know, one of his ideas was around moving from the collective in terms of, you know, the sort of congregation in the church and the kind of rules and regulations handed down to the individual. That idea of individual conscience, of individual liberty to read the scriptures and make your own decisions about them, ends up, move forward a century to the 17th to the 18th century, to enlightened ideas. I'm not sure Luther would have actually had, certainly wouldn't have had that in mind, and he probably, wherever he's sitting, let's hope he's up in heaven, since he was so keen on those things, that he would look down and be rather surprised. So I think, as with all these black and white things, is he one thing or the other? I would say he's probably both.
I think we'll stick with this question as we're stuck into it now. Was he a fundamentalist reactionary or the enlightened creator of the modern world, Ulinka?
These labels are, of course, very unhelpful and misleading, as the historian is bound to say. I mean, one of the great myths is, and it's still upheld by parts of the Protestant church today, is that he paved the way to modernity for a more individual relationship with conscience and with the Bible. But one of the reasons why he insists so much being doctor of theology is because he says the Holy Spirit rests in Wittenberg and with him, and he's the only one who has got the authority to interpret the Bible. So very early and through the Peasants' War, he becomes deeply authoritarian. So I don't think really that he encouraged either a spirit of dialogue. We already touched this. So I don't see in those areas enlightened thinking. Of course, turning once more to the question of sexuality, you might say that there, you know, that depends on your standpoint, that there are enlightened elements there.
The sexuality thing is really important, because the medieval church had assumed that celibacy, virginity, were the ideal states to which everything else was a falling away. Luther reversed that. Protestantism reversed that. So now marriage is the ideal state, and you might therefore say that sexuality is given a more positive place. Celibacy, virginity are bad things. So that makes him more like us than it makes him like medieval people. Fundamentalism, you can't really say he's a fundamentalist, which is, it's a 19th century idea. He values the word of God, but he plays fast and loose with the text of the Bible. If it suits him, if it suits his great idea, the just shall live by faith, then he's all for it. And he actually rewrote the Bible a little in his translations. Wherever he saw the word faith, he made it faith alone. Not there in the original. So he can play with the Bible because it's his, and it's ours, and it's God's. He wrestles with it. He calls the Bible our enemy because we are in constant conversation with it. It's like the name Israel, which means he who struggles with God. And he would see that as the eternal human condition, struggling with God. The Bible is a struggle.
If we could get a microphone back and ask this gentleman, were you happy with the answers? You asked the crucial question. Well, you're nodding. I'll take that, as they say in America. Right, now, up the gentleman there who has been waiting for a while. Thank you on the end.
To what extent do you agree with Cardinal Jerome Alexander's view that Erasmus laid the egg that Luther hatched?
The egg question. Ulinka.
I think you could say that. I mean, so Erasmus, we can think of his 1511 Praise of Folly, where he, of course, writes against the mendicant, the begging orders, and you know, satirizes the bishops who never seem to be in residence, so on and so forth. And then Luther takes this up and really leads it into very different directions. And we covered where he and Erasmus are really very fundamentally different thinkers. So in a very broad way, I would agree with that.
Could I add, I think one of the things about Erasmus is Erasmus never wanted to risk breaking the Catholic Church in that sense. He was very witty, he was very funny, he poked fun at them, he made the leadership look very foolish. He was very, very happy to do all of those things. But he when it came to risking himself, When he felt himself to be at risk, he disappeared off to Switzerland, where he thought he was safer. Luther was prepared to risk everything. And I know Erasmus is a much more revered and popular figure now, and we all think how wise and modern, forward-looking he was. But actually, in terms of sort of courage and following through his arguments, I think Luther has a bit of an edge.
Okay, well, there's a fair vote there for Luther. Yep, here we go. Another question. Thank you.
How has the Catholic Church's view of Luther changed over the 500 years since?
You're appointing Peter as spokesman here, are you?
I am, for our
purposes this evening.
I am the Pope, obviously.
And well, you wear it so lightly, sir.
It didn't do very well for a very, very long time. So until the 20th century, it was still putting forward the most ridiculous slurs against him. The one that said his mother was a prostitute, or whatever, all the things that the Catholic Church would say because it's obsessed by sex. But the Second Vatican Council, incredibly important in the history of the Catholic Church, 1962 to 1965, the Second Vatican Council, sort of, as well as a general opening to the modern world, begins a dialogue with Lutheranism, which goes forward until 1999, where Catholicism and Lutheranism basically say they agree on most things, and that process has been going forward. And the thing that is most remarkable about 2017, for those of us who look too closely at the Catholic Church, is that these celebrations of the 500th anniversary are being jointly hosted by the World Lutheran Federation and by the Vatican. They're doing it together. They talk about a joint fest for Jesus Christ, which sounds a bit naff, but that is what they're doing. And I think, as well as the sort of, you know, the kind of Reformation sort of turned on its head idea about that, we live in an age, don't we, where most people will tell you, if you tell them you're even remotely religious, they don't like religion because religion causes all wars. And of course, they'll point to Luther and the 100 years of war after his death. But here we are in a situation, and I absolutely admit it took an awfully long time, but here we are at a time where those terrible wounds, that terrible upset, has actually been healed, and no one said a word about it, really.
Luther and Catholicism, and perhaps David, a word on Luther and reception in other churches.
Well, that would take us into a whole new ball game, but it must be remembered all the time that the Reformation did divide between Lutherans on the one hand and not Lutherans, let's call them something else, because not Lutherans doesn't sound very good, Reformed Protestants. English Protestantism became Reformed and not Lutheran. So there are two sorts of Protestantisms with two different characteristics, and it must be said that Luther is much closer to Rome than the Reformed. And that's one reason why it was so easy in the 20th century to say, yeah, Luther was actually right on most things. And that's what Roman Catholic theologians did start saying in the 1960s.
We've been keeping back one reason. We've kept back one reading, and it's chosen by Peter. I think this is the moment to hear it. It returns us to Luther and his particular sense of vocation. Peter.
Yes, this is another piece from the Table Talks. And we've talked about Luther being very egotistical, not being able to accept that other people thought other people's views, thinking he was always right. The most important thing to think about Luther, and to an extent, you know, we may put it down as a delusion, is that he felt that he was being guided by God. And obviously, if people tell us that, we often think they're slightly bonkers. But Luther believed this very sincerely. So this is how he describes, this is his summing up, really, of what happened. This is his Reformation story, as it were. I was thrown into the battle over the gospel by God, without knowing it was happening. If I had known then what I have now learned from experience, in no case would I have suffered that he would put me to that work. But God's wisdom is greater than human wisdom. He simply blinded me, the way one puts blinders on a horse when one wants it to stay on the path. And then when I first started with it, I truly said to our Lord God, in all earnestness and from the bottom of my heart in my study, if he wanted me to begin a production solely in his interest and selected it for me, then I would join in that. That is, put my wisdom into it. He heard and empowered that prayer. May his grace sustain me.
It's a lovely way to end with that sort of ringing Luther voice in our heads. But why do you think the world would have looked, Peter, without Luther in it?
gosh, what ifs of history are always very different, isn't it? I mean, at its simplest, Luther broke the stranglehold of the Catholic Church over Europe. I suspect it would have happened anyway, but he was the one who had the courage to it. The thing that struck me most in looking at Luther's life, and I think this is something that's very relevant now, is just the extraordinary courage that he had. And I think when you look at his courage, we can put it down to kind of arrogance, we can put it down to egotism, thinking of Donald Trump again, we could put it down to narcissism, or whatever we want to put it down to. Luther himself put his courage down to God, and perhaps we should respect that slightly more.
Ulinka, the what-ifs of history attached to that great German figure, what would it have looked like without Martin Luther on our books?
In advance, is this program not going to ask any counterfactual questions?
Well, it doesn't mean we won't.
I would agree with the view that the pressure for reform was so great that I think some form of reform probably would have happened. But it's very hard to tell. I mean, there are people like Erasmus who believe there is going to be a reform pope, and very briefly there is one, then again not. So that could have been another scenario that people would have just hung on to that hope for a reform pope.
They would have hung on without Luther for something else to come along, Dermot.
Yes, the church would have split because it's the normal condition of Christianity to be split. The exception was the 1,000 years of Western Latin Christendom from 500 to 1500. That's an aberration in Christian history. But I think the thing which Luther left, and which has become the centre of Western culture, is the thing he may probably not have said. It's a bit like knocking the nail, the thesis on the door. Well, he may not have said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." But he ought to have done. Because that is at the center of Protestantism. That ultimately, no authority stands between you and God. You stand alone before God, and therefore you turn out to humanity and stand alone after that conversation.
And that's where we must leave the fascinating story of Martin Luther. Thank you to all of my guests, Ulinka Rublack, Dermot McCulloch and Peter Stanford, and my producer Zahid Worley, and to all of you here at the London School of Economics. Good night.